Hello and welcome to the IFRIC Update podcast for September 2012. My name is Michael Stewart, Director of Implementation Activities at the IASB, and I'm joined today by Ken Yoshimura and Kazu Sakaguchi to talk about some of the issues that were discussed by the IFRS Interpretations Committee at their September 2012 Interpretations Committee meeting. The committee met on the 18th and 19th of September. Now, the comments that you'll hear expressed in this podcast will be those of the presenters and not necessarily those of the IASB or the IFRS Interpretations Committee. Start off with an issue that the committee has been looking at for a couple of months now, and that is to do with employee benefits question, and it relates to employee benefit plans with a promised return on contributions or notional contributions. Now, this is related to the accounting for contribution-based promises that the committee has looked at before, and building on the work on that, and in particular work on old interpretation and draft interpretation D9, the committee has restarted work to develop an interpretation to deal with these kinds of plans. At this meeting, the committee discussed details about the scope of the plans that it would like to include within its draft interpretation, and it decided that the plans that fall within the scope of its work should have the following characteristics. They should be plans that will be classified as defined contribution plans under RAS 19 if it weren't for the guarantee provided by the employer on the return of contributions made. That the contributions made to plans could be notional contributions as opposed to actual contributions. That there should be a guarantee of return by the employer on the contributions. And that the benefit under the plans should not be dependent on future events, such as salary changes, vesting or demographic risk, and that the guarantee under the plan may be based on the value of one or more underlying assets. Now, the concern has been to date that IAS 19 doesn't sufficiently address these types of plans, and there have been efforts made in the past to address this, both through D9 to determine how such plans should be accounted for and how to what extent IAS 19 should be applied to them. Now, the committee also looked at a number of issues on which it has published tentative agenda decisions. Now, these tentative agenda decisions are published in IFRIC Update, and comments are invited on these by the 26th of November 2012, and then the comments received will be discussed at the January 2013 committee meeting. There were four issues that the committee looked at and issued tentative agenda decisions on. I'll look at one of them in detail, and it's one related to IAS 39, and the presentation in the Statement of Comprehensive Income of income and expenses arising on financial instruments with a negative yield. This situation that doesn't occur often, but perhaps in the current environment we do see occasionally. And it's where, for example, a financial asset has a negative effective interest rate. And so the question arose as to how the expense that would arise as a consequence of having a negative effective interest rate on a financial asset, how that expense should be presented in the financial statements. Now, the committee looked at this, and its tentative view is that that amount would not be appropriate to present as interest income, because it doesn't meet the definition of interest revenue in IAS 18, that being because it is a gross outflow of economic benefits instead of a gross inflow, as would be required by IAS 18 for interest revenue. Neither did they think it was an interest expense, because the amount, this expense, is arising on a financial asset and not on a financial liability. So as a consequence of that, it considered that that expense should not be presented as interest expense. So the committee, in concluding on this, took the view that the amount should be presented neither as interest revenue nor interest expense, but presented in some other appropriate expense classification. And as a result of the guidance that the committee saw within IAS 1 already, it felt that it did not need to add this issue to its agenda. Now, this issue and the other three issues, one relating to IFRS 3 and continuing employment, a second relating to IAS 27 and IFRS 10 to do with the non-cash acquisition of a non-controlling interest by a controlling shareholder in consolidated financial statements, and the third being an IAS 28 issue relating to impairment of investments in associates in separate financial statements. All four of these are open for comment until 26th November 2012. Then turning to the committee's work in progress, I'd like to turn first to an issue related to IAS 19 and the measurement of the net defined benefit obligation, the DBO, for post-employment benefit plans with employee contributions. And Kazu, yes. This particular issue is one that you've been working on. Yes. What is the concern that was raised and brought to the committee's attention?
Okay, Michael, this is a new issue that's been brought attention to the attention of the committee. And it is about how to account for employee contributions in accordance with paragraph 93 of IAS 19 employee benefits. The standards was issued in 2011 and will be effective from annual periods beginning on after 1st January 2013. The submitter of this issue thinks that paragraph 93 was intended to address measurement of the net defined benefit obligation if the risk of plan is shared with employees through their contributions to the plan. However, the second sentence of paragraph 93 states that contributions from employees or third parties in respect of service are attributed to periods of service as a negative benefit in accordance with paragraph 70. So the submitter is concerned that the guidance would affect any plan with employee contributions, and that may result in a change in measurement of the net DBO for virtually all plans with employee contributions. And according to the submitter, in current practice, employee contributions reduce the gross service cost in the period in which they are received. The submitter is also concerned that in periods in which the discount rate increases, employee contributions made in earlier periods have higher value, which may cause the net DBO to be backloaded and increase DBO. The submitter is further concerned with the determination of the opening balance of the net DBO in doing the retrospective application, because data on employees' past contributions may no longer exist to make that determination. The submitter understands that some advisors have already indicated they intended to ignore paragraph 93 because they believe IAS 19 was not intended to change the method used to calculate the DBO. Those advisors' views are based on the statements by the ISB that measurement issues will be addressed in a later phase of the project. So the submitter thinks application of paragraph 93 and effectively 70 of IAS 19 will be mixed.
Okay, so there's concerns over the number of schemes or the scope of schemes that will be affected by the requirement to account for the employee contributions, and also this requirement to look at the backloading of those contributions to the scheme.
Yes, that's correct.
So what has the committee discussed about this, and what are they proposing to do at this stage?
Good. First of all, let me start with the proposal I made to the committee. And first of all, we conducted outreach to the International Forum of Accounting Standard Setters and also to the ISB's Employee Benefits Working Group. And looking at the comments we received, deducting employee contributions from the gross service cost in the current period seems the most common approach in current practice, as the submitter said. So in determining whether paragraph 93 is intended to be a clarification of the requirements in the current IAS 19 or intended to be a change in measurement approach of the DBO. We started analysis with looking at the discussion made in ISB meeting in February 2011. At that meeting, the ISB discussed various aspects of risk sharing features based on the comments received from the exposure draft at the time. And one of the proposed amendments in the ED included the statement that the present value of the of contributions that were receivable from employees in respect of current service cost or past service cost are included in the determination of the defined benefit obligation. And according to the ISB update at the time, one of the tentative decisions by the ISB was to confirm the proposal that the effect of employee contributions should be deducted in determining the defined benefit obligation. So if I look at those discussions and decisions, we think requirements in the ED and the ISB's decision for that meeting and also paragraph 93 are all consistent. They all require that employee contributions should be considered in calculating the DBO. Employee contributions linked to employee service are part of the funding of the total benefits paid to employees. So in other words, the ultimate cost of a defined benefit plan is shared between employees and the employer. So on the basis of this analysis, we think paragraph 93 is a clarification of the requirements in the current IS 19 and not a change in measurement approach of the DBO.
Okay, so how can the committee help in respect of the concerns raised?
We brought that analysis to the interpretations committee. And first of all, the committee observed that the proposal in the exposure draft at the time and the ISB's decision at its meeting in February 2011 and also the requirements in paragraph 93 are consistent with each other. The committee observed that they all require that employee contributions, including expected future contributions resulting from employee service in the current and prior periods, should be considered in calculating the DBO. That is a tentative observation by the interpretations committee. However, taking into account the general concern of the submitter and also the concerns from other interested parties, the committee asked the staff to bring some specific examples on how to account for employee contributions in accordance with paragraph 93. So the interpretations committee will review the examples at a future meeting and see how to address this issue.
Okay, good. So so something to look at in terms of the example accounting at the next time. Good.
Yes.
Thank you. Now, Ken, the other issue that I wanted to talk about today related to IAS 40 and investment property, and a rather interesting question, I thought, arising relating to the accounting for a structure that appears to lack the physical characteristics of a building. Now, what do we mean by that?
Yeah, thank you, Michael. Let me start off with a brief summary of the background of this issue. This issue is related to a telecommunication tower which doesn't have walls, floors, or roof, but permanently built on a piece of land. And the telecommunication tower, which is used for better network access in the area, used to be owned by telecommunication operators, and therefore they are generally accounted for as PP&E under IS 16 because the tower is used for their own business, which is providing network services to end customers. However, because of the recent business developments, now we can see situations in which the telecommunication operators sell their towers to a tower leasing company, or the tower leasing company receives an order from those telecommunication operators to build a tower and leases spaces in the tower to the operators. So we can say this issue arose from an emerging business model. And the submitter of this issue asked to clarify whether the lessor of the tower should account for the telecommunication tower as PP&E under IS 16 or as investment property under IS 40. And they raised 2 points to be discussed in the discussion. And first point is whether the telecommunication tower should be viewed as a building, as Michael mentioned, and therefore property for the purpose of IS 40, because paragraph 5 of IS 40 defines investment property as a building or land or both of them. And second point is how the service element in the leasing agreement and business model of the entity should be considered when analyzing whether the telecom tower should be within the scope of IS-40. And the submitter said there's an argument that the main element of the arrangement in this case may not be leasing spaces in the tower, but rather providing services related to telecommunication network for the operators. And this is why telecom tower should be viewed as owner-occupied property as defined in paragraph 5 of IS-40. And another argument related to the service element is that the tower is used for ordinary activities of its business rather than for investment, because the leasing company's business model is to lease the tower to telecommunication operators. This is also could lead to the conclusion that the tower should be viewed as owner-occupied property that should be accounted for as PP&E and IS-16.
Okay.
These are issues in the background.
Yes. So focus here and the tension points being, does IS-40 require it to be a building? And if so, what do we mean by a building? Or is it focused more on the concept of leasing space? And therefore, is that the thing that should be focused on? Or indeed, the point you mentioned last there, which is, well, what is a leasing model? Isn't it to do with having a particular asset which you rent out and therefore should be treated as property, plant and equipment? So where has the committee got to with its discussions so far?
With regard to the second point, which is associated with the service element, the committee observed that an entity is required to assess whether ancillary services are significant to the arrangement as a whole, as required in IS-40, acknowledging that the main element of the arrangement in this case would be leasing of spaces in the tower. But most of the time of the meeting was spent on the first point, which is related to the definition of a building. And in the meeting, the committee agreed that a key to this issue is the meaning of the term building in paragraph 5 of IS-40. And in addition, the committee generally agreed that the telecommunication tower in this specific case has some of the characteristics of investment property, because spaces in the tower are let to tenants to and renters, which is consistent with the definition of investment property. But on the flip side, the committee also noted that the tower might be viewed as equipment rather than building, because as argued in the submission, the tower looks different from a general building, which we can see in the street. So the tower does not have walls, floors, or roof. And in English dictionary, the building is generally described as a structure which has walls and a roof. And the committee also concerned that this issue could arise about other types of structure, such as gas storage tanks and advertising billboards, because they are similar in terms of leasing spaces to tenants and they do not have walls either. And another concern is that on the basis of the result of the outreach conducted by the staff, in all jurisdictions that have similar transactions, the tower is generally accounted for as PP&E under S16. And some of them mentioned that this is because that kind of structure is not viewed as a building in their jurisdiction for the purpose of IS-40. Consequently, the committee was not able to reach a consensus on whether the telecom tower in this case should be accounted for under S40 or whether some amendments should be made to the standards. So in a future meeting, the staff will bring further analysis to let the committee decide whether amendments to the scope of IS-40 could or should be made.
Okay. So we'll be looking at that again at a future meeting.
Yes.
Thank you. Well, that brings us to the end of this podcast on the events of the IFRS Interpretations Committee in September 2012. Just a reminder that the full record of the proceedings of the committee at the September meeting is available in the September 2012 IFRIC Update newsletter, which can be found on the IFRS website. And just to mention again that the views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the presenters and not necessarily those of the ISB or the IFRS Interpretations Committee. Thank you very much for listening.